Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing WatsonX Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with WatsonX Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM, let's create.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
We have a fun journey to take you on in the next couple of episodes. Probably going to be a two-parter, but who knows? We never know. We don't know what the future is going to bring. But this is one that, on the surface of things, you might think, "Oh well, oil and water. How interesting could that get?" But it gets pretty interesting because we're going to get into divination. We're going to get into the idea of pouring storm oil into the sea to calm turbulent waters. There's a lot to talk about here. But at the very base level, oil and water, two things that famously don't mix. You've probably observed varying levels of the interaction before. Perhaps you've just seen like a film of oil on the surface of a puddle, or you've observed the separation of cooking oil combined with another liquid in a mixing bowl. It instantly catches the eye. I'm not going to say it necessarily always captures the human imagination, but there is something about it that you can't help but notice.
Did you ever have one of those toys when you were a kid where there is, I actually don't know what liquids they use in these, but presumably it's water and then some kind of lipid-based colored liquid, maybe like red or blue, that bubbles through the water and maybe spins a little pinwheel or something?
Yeah, I think I know what you're talking about. I do remember these. They're really fun for a brief period of time, and then they go into the junk drawer.
Well, maybe I'm just easily amused. I remember turning mine over and over a lot.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's memorable. I'm not saying it's forgotten, but it certainly ends up in the toy chest.
I bet that one's really fun when it breaks. That'd be a great origin story for like a long dormant virus or something, a dangerous microorganism encased within the item of power.
What strange oil did they end up using? Yeah. Well, it's not just children. It's not just the inner child as well. Humans have found interactions of oil and water intriguing since ancient times. And yeah, indeed, it does trace back into the realm of ancient magic and divination. Various tales, and we'll touch on some of these, of like ancient kings and so forth, seeking out the word and the wisdom of diviners who use various methods to sort of reach into the murky future and make sense of the strange shapes there. Now, divination is, of course, the attempt to seek guidance concerning the future and decisions that impact future events. As we've discussed in the show before, you can certainly think of it as the rite of supernatural guidance, which it is. But especially in the ancient context, too, we might think of it as well as a means of sort of generating a randomized direction that is weighted by belief or superstition. If presented with two choices, all things being equal, flip a coin. but not a trivial coin, not a completely trivial coin, because this coin is weighted by supernatural belief. But then also, you keep it from being just, you know, completely random, because it also entails an art of interpretation. It's not just a coin anyone can flip and anyone can read. You need a specialist who's going to read the coin, read whatever it is you're reading, and perhaps too, you know, read the client, read the patron, and or the you know, the larger events going on. So yeah, there's an art to divination as well.
Though it's often interesting when you think about a lot of the stories of what the interpreter does. I mean, there are some cases where they get real specific about things, but most of the time it seems like they are adding in ambiguity that makes it harder to falsify the prediction.
Yeah, sort of the you know, there's obviously an art to the cold read, and, you know, there's a level of manipulation to carrying it out as well. And also there's a lot of self-preservation, especially when you're dealing with, you know, dark and gloomy kings in ancient times. If you want to be a diviner that lives a long life, or even a reasonably long life, you do have to read the room and figure out exactly what kind of message you're going to relay to the ruler.
Look, I only said there would be a decisive victory. I didn't say which side would get it.
So there are various methods of divination that have been used over the years. We talked about many on the show before in the past, and we're going to touch on several different ones here, but specifically concerning oil and water divination. This is what the ancient Greeks would come to call lecanomancy, the use of oil poured into a basin of water to tell the future.
Yeah, so the name lecanomancy comes from the Greek lekane, meaning bowl. So this is lecanomancy, meaning bowl divination. And in the literature, yeah, it seems most often to refer to omens in mixtures of oil or water, either in a bowl or in a cup, and could apparently be done either way, maybe by, I think more often by pouring oil into water, but maybe also by pouring water into oil. Though there are some other definitions for this word that seem to overlap with the concept of hydromancy, meaning divination through water. And since the name only means bowl, like the name doesn't mean oil, I guess it could also involve these other things, like you have a bowl of water and you drop gems in it and see what they do to get your omen, or you drop gold or silver coins in, or you like move the water around and see which way the ripples go. There are a number of ways of doing this, but the oil and water one seems to have been prominent in the ancient Near East.
Yeah. This lines up with what I was reading as well. I was looking at a book from 1981 titled Oracles and Divination. And in particular, there's a section in it by O.R. Gurney that says, yes, these practices, they tended to involve a bowl or a basin of some sort. And yes, one would either pour oil into water or water into oil. And the oil would cause various shapes on the surface of the water. And these would be used through the diviner's art, or the baru's art, I believe baru was the term in like ancient Babylon, to predict the future. There is also a variation called aluromancy, which used flour instead of oil. So, you know, take heart. If you're out of oil and you have some flour on hand, you can also go with that method.
Make you the loosest of doughs.
Now, Gurney also mentions that there now are slash were, I'm not sure if this is like the current count, this is again a text from 81, the 6 known surviving tablets from ancient Mesopotamia dealing with oil omens. And the author includes a couple of examples here that I wanted to read. So these would be, you know, different nuggets of wisdom to help you, the diviner, interpret what's happening in the bowl. Quote, if from the middle of the oil 2 drops come out, one big, the other small, the man's wife will bear a son. For a sick man, he will recover. And then the next one here concerns the use of flour instead of oil. If the flour in the east takes the shape of a lion's face, the man is in the grip of a ghost of one who lies in the open country. The sun will consign it, the ghost, to the wind, and he will get well.
Ooh, wow, that's creepy. So wait, flower forms a lion's face. Does that mean a ghost of one who lies in the open country? Does that mean a ghost of someone who like didn't receive a proper burial? Would that be?
That was what it made me think of. I'm not certain, and the author doesn't go into detail on this, but yeah, it made me think of other superstitions we've discussed from other traditions involving the unburied or the improperly buried dead.
This was a subject often of great concern in the literature and folklore of the ancient world, that like people, like not getting a proper burial was really something you didn't want.
Yeah. Now, another form of divination that he mentions is labanomancy, which is divination by smoke from throwing cedar shavings on an incense burner. And this would, you know, be kind of similar. Like you throw the wood shavings on there, smoke billows up, and however the smoke is moving, what shapes it seems to be forming, that is the basis of your vision of the future.
Mm.
Now, he writes that the use of entrails in, you know, in a sacrificed animal would become more popular, but oil, flour, and smoke-based divination would remain a cheaper option, but also still one that would be invoked and used by various important individuals, including kings, such as when Kassite King Agum II, he says, prayed to the god Shamash by oil before setting out on a quest to reclaim stolen statues of Marduk and Sarpanitum.
It's interesting that you mention lacanomancy as a cheaper alternative to reading omens in the entrails of sacrificed animals. I came across that exact same claim in some other sources. I don't know if they're citing from a common source that that says that. But yeah, that is interesting, obviously. So I guess the benefit of reading the entrails of a sacrificed animal is you're almost like, you know, you're paying for the really high price ticket for your your message from the gods. Like you're taking a good animal, getting it sacrificed, I suppose, at the altar of the god you're asking for the answer from, and then its entrails will tell you something. And the budget option, yeah, is just a little bit of olive oil and some water or some flour or something like that.
Yeah, but and I'm just guessing here, but I mean, maybe that's not always available. Maybe sometimes the old ways are thought the best, or maybe sometimes you have a situation where even a king is getting a second or third opinion on a matter, and it's like, well, okay, what do the lacanomancers have to say about this? Maybe they'll give me the answer that I want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
Now the author here, Gurney, goes on and mentions that there's also a form of lacanomancy that was used by the Hittites that involved a basin of or a tub filled with water, certainly, but instead of adding oil or flour, you would add what might be a snake or possibly an eel, and its movements in the enclosed space of the tank would foretell the future. And it does not, in this case, sound like the animal was sacrificed. It's just about, you know, put the animal in there, watch it swim around. How does it behave? Its movements are going to reveal what the future holds for us.
Mm-hmm.
Now, another source I was looking at concerning this topic appears in The Influence of Surface Films on Interfacial Flow Dynamics from 1997 by Sean Patrick McKenna. And this author writes that lacanomancy is, of course, one of the forms of divination practiced during the 18th century BCE in the Hammurabi-ruled Old Babylonian Empire, and points out, yeah, there's several tablets of the time period unearthed in the 19th and 20th centuries that list examples of lacanomancy and, you know, guides for interpreting what's going on in the water. This author also shares some examples translated from these tablets. A few of these include the following. If the oil sinks, then rises and spreads round the water, for the campaign unfavorable consequences, for the sick, divine punishment. If the oil splits in two, for the campaign, both camps should march together. For the sick, death. If a drop emerges in the east and remains stationary, for the campaign, booty. For the sick, recovery. If two drops emerge, one large, one small, a male child will be born. For the sick, recovery. If the oil fills the bowl, for the sick, death. For the campaign, defeat for the leader.
This last one actually raises questions for me, because the question is, if the oil fills the bowl, knowing what we know about the physics of oil and water today, I mean, I think what will pretty much always happen is that over time, any oil in the water will spread out as far as it can. And so it will pretty much always spread to fill the surface of water in a bowl. But it takes time for it to do that. So maybe you got to put a time limit on it. Otherwise, it's always going to be death or defeat for the leader, I would think.
Yeah, I think there has to be an immediacy to this. And and obviously, especially if you don't have a steady hand, all of your divinations can't be, death for the sick and defeat for the leader of an army.
Yeah.
That's going to be bad for business, I think.
But it's interesting to see the pairings of the different interpretations with like the two different kinds of battles, the battle for health within the body and the battle, in the military campaign going on for the king. So some of these pairings make sense to me, like unfavorable consequences for the military campaign with divine punishment for the sick, death and defeat. Booty and recovery, that pairing makes sense. The one I was confused about is if the oil splits in two, that means for the sick, death, for the campaign, both camps should march together.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure what to make of that either.
Yeah. Though I like that because that's not just stating an outcome, that's giving advice.
Yeah. Now, obviously, another issue that all this raises is, what kinds of oil are you using? Indeed, what kinds of water? There could conceivably be differences in the reaction that takes place. Well, one source I looked at, this is from D. Tabor. This is from 1980, Babylonian Lacanomancy, an ancient text on the spreading of oil on water. And in that, the author suggests that the water here is likely rainwater and the oil is some manner of vegetable oil. I found that interesting, like the rainwater, especially because on one hand, okay, I guess this is going to be how you're going to obtain the purest water that is also free of any oils that might, otherwise contaminate it. And then on the other hand, there is something kind of supernatural to it as well. Like this is the water that came from the sky, from the realm of the gods. And therefore, I can imagine that playing a role in all of this as well. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name.
Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Now, another interesting thing that came up in one of these sources is they pointed this out, Joe, that apparently in the Old Testament, in Genesis 44:5, there is a reference to lecanomancy. There's a bit that goes, "Is not this it in which my Lord drinketh, and whereby indeed he divineth? Ye have done evil in so doing."
So this is a very interesting case. I think this is not necessarily a reference to lecanomancy, though that is a good candidate for what it is referring to. It is definitely referring to a form of divination, which means I think maybe this is a good time for a digression on references to divination in the Bible. And here I have to apologize because I got seriously overzealous in pursuing this digression, which is only lightly related to the topic to begin with. So please bear with me. But I think it's an interesting subject. So there are actually a lot of references to divination in the Bible. The Hebrew Bible, or what Christians would call the Old Testament, contains references to a bunch of different methods of divination. First of all, there is actually a divination method officially sanctioned by the Torah and by the priest class in the Bible, which is known as the Urim and Thummim, which seems to have been some other kind of object. It's like a pair of objects worn on the ceremonial breastplate of the high priest. And while the exact form of these objects and the procedure for using them is not certain, it seems they would essentially be used for casting lots of some kind by the high priest in order to receive answers from God. Possibly answers to yes or no questions about what would happen in the future, like will we be successful in battle and so forth, or answers to questions about the guilt or innocence of an alleged sinner. Sometimes they're represented as like gems that flash with a divine light in order to project messages. I think there were some interpretations in the later rabbinical literature like this, but I think that's all sort of like later writers speculating on what these original passages in the scriptures meant.
Now, the Urim and Thummim here, if I'm correct on this, this is this kind of often depicted as kind of a multicolored, like you said, crystal plate that is worn from the neck. And I remember as a child, I would experience a certain amount of excitement and maybe a little bit of confusion, because at the time I would have my Star Wars books on one hand, mm-hmm. and then I would have, you know, some of these illustrated like Old Testament stories books on the other. Mm-hmm. And these looked like these made me think of the chest plate of Darth Vader.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, the chest plate of Darth Vader, like it's got all the little Tic Tacs and stuff on it.
Mm-hmm. Red lights and all. And oftentimes these illustrations, you see some sort of like red gems in there as well.
Yeah. So I think what is clear is that these objects are linked to the breastplate of the high priest in some way. Like it said that maybe they are put in or put on the breastplate, but it's not exactly clear what they are.
Hmm.
But what is clear is that they are somehow used in an officially in-bounds divination process. This is what the followers of the God of Israel were supposed to use for divination purposes if they needed to. But the Hebrew Bible also contains numerous references to other forms of divination, such as necromancy. This is apparently a big concern in the era of the Mosaic Law. And despite its modern interpretation as a kind of evil sorcery used for like calling up armies of undead skeleton soldiers and mm-hmm. zombie swarms to go, get your paladins, originally necromancy meant communication with the dead for the purpose of divination, not raising zombie soldiers.
Now, to be clear, even in like the modern Dungeons and Dragons usage of necromancy, yes, there's a lot of calling up the dead and using all sorts of, you know, weird spectral hands and so forth. There is still a little bit of talking to the dead, though. They do.
Oh, yeah?
They keep it real a little bit there. And we see a bit of that in the recent Dungeons and Dragons movie. There's a whole scene of speaking with the dead, trying to gain wisdom from them.
Oh, yeah. It's played mostly for comedy, I recall.
Yeah.
Like they have a fixed number of questions they can ask and so forth. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's what necromancy means in this context, though. It's not, yeah, it's not the zombie soldiers. It's the talking to the dead for the purposes of gaining hidden information or knowing the past or knowing the future. Anyway, in the Mosaic Law, there are general prohibitions against divination and wizardry and magic of all forms. But one of the forms of divination that is specifically called out in these verses is necromancy. Also, there is a very famous story in the Bible about a consultation with a dead prophet. This is in 1 Samuel chapter 28, where Saul, the king of Israel, famously, he goes to a village called Endor to meet with a wise woman or a witch who can speak to the dead. And this is significant in the story because Saul has condemned witchcraft and has previously banished all the wizards and fortune tellers from Israel. But then he's facing a military conflict with another nation, with the Philistines, and he wants to know what he should do. And apparently he, you know, he tries to get an answer from the sanctioned methods of information. He tries to consult the Urim and Thummim. He tries to have a dream from God or get some kind of direct revelation, and nothing. Ends up with no guidance, has no idea what to do from any of the official channels. So he goes rogue. He violates his own edict. He puts on a disguise and seeks out a necromancer to speak to the dead prophet Samuel. He wants to get Samuel's advice on what he should do. And this does not go well. So he does go to the woman in disguise. She figures out it's Saul, by the way. She's like, oh, wait a minute. You said we're not allowed to do this. And he's like, oh, no, don't worry about it. I need you to talk to Samuel. So she raises Samuel from the grave. I think she can see him, but Saul can't. And he's trying to talk with him, and Samuel just does not help. He seems to be kind of irritated for being woken up from the sleep of death. And then he condemns Saul for his treachery. And then Samuel tells him that his army is going to be defeated and he will lose his kingship. And Samuel is right. The army is defeated, and Saul falls on his own sword and dies. And the story seems to at least in part emphasize how you really shouldn't go off trail on divination methods.
Yeah, stick to the legal methods. Don't go into illegal divination.
By the way, if you've never seen it, everyone should look up William Blake's painting of Saul and the spirit of Samuel and the Witch of Endor.
Brilliant, brilliant. Yeah, I mean, all of Blake's illustrations, those hand-colored illustrations, are always so great. This one's no exception. By the way, the Witch of Endor would also come to play a part in the 1985 film, The Battle for Endor. Weird House Cinema listeners may remember. No real connection to the biblical account, other than we're dealing with a moon of Endor and there is a witch on it.
You are also not supposed to divine the future with the help of Wilford Brimley. But anyway, so that's a story from the Bible from after the delivery of the Mosaic Law, which contains all of these prohibitions against divination in general, presumably with the exception of the Urim and Thummim, and the prohibitions against necromancy in particular. But there are also interesting references to divination from before the law, when it seems to have different connotations. So one of these that occurs here is the example you raised earlier. This is where we're coming back to lacanomancy. This is the story of Joseph in the book of Genesis, which is a long and complicated story. So I'll try to do the very condensed and simplified version. Joseph is one of the 12 sons of the biblical patriarch Jacob. And Jacob in the story shows favoritism toward him over his other brothers, even buying him a splendid coat of many colors. They made a musical about it.
Yes, yeah, classic story.
But his brothers, who are less favored by their father, become very jealous. So one day they conspire, they beat him up, they trap him in a well, and they sell him into slavery, where he ends up being transported to Egypt. But they take Joseph's coat to their father, covered in the blood of a goat, and convince him that Joseph was killed by a wild animal.
again, classic children's story. I remember reading it alongside my Star Wars as a child.
But in Egypt, Joseph does pretty well. He manages to rise from lowly servitude, and at one point he's imprisoned, and he manages to rise out of that to the rank of the Pharaoh's most senior lieutenant. He's like the number two in Egypt. And the way he does this is by showing a talent for divination. He is able to interpret the omens of the future in dreams. And by correctly analyzing Pharaoh's dreams, he brings great prosperity to Egypt at a time of famine for all the surrounding nations. And actually, since it matters to my interpretation of this story in a minute, the specific way this works is that the Pharaoh dreams of seven fat cows that are like eaten, they're like swallowed up by seven lean cows, and seven rotten stalks of grain that consume seven good stalks of grain. And Joseph realizes that this means there are going to be 7 years of good crops followed by 7 years of famine. And so to anticipate the famine, the Egyptians must ration their good crops and store up extra grain during the years of abundance. Joseph's prediction, or his interpretation of the dream, comes true. And so later, suffering from famine, like all of the surrounding nations are, Joseph's brothers come to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph, whom they do not recognize. They don't know it's him. And then they have several interactions, actually. But in the last one, in secret, Joseph hides his silver cup in the grain bag carried by his youngest brother, Benjamin. He then arranges to have his youngest brother caught, quote, stealing the cup. Again, he actually planted it on him, and then demands Benjamin be given to him as a slave as punishment. And instead, their older brother Judah asks that he be made a slave in Benjamin's place. And this causes Joseph to break down in tears. He reveals his identity. He forgives his brothers, and the family is reunited and allowed to relocate to a fertile part of Egypt. But it is the part of the story about the silver cup that relates to divination. So when Joseph's steward finds the silver cup hidden in Benjamin's sack, he says, just as Joseph commands him to, he says, "Why have you repaid evil for good? Is not this the one from which my Lord drinks and with which he indeed practices divination? You have done evil in so doing." Now, of course, it doesn't say exactly what kind of divination he does in the cup. So it could be a form of hydromancy where you would, you know, put water in the cup or some liquid and drop coins or gems or other objects into the water and see what they do. It could be maybe used for a form of scrying, since it's silver. Scrying is reading the future in reflections in a shiny surface, such as a silver cup. Often a crystal ball is used for scrying. But based on a lot of the commentaries I found, a good candidate for what is being described here is lacanomancy, where he would be, you know, dropping oil into water or doing one of the other things we've been talking about. But in any case, I think this passage is interesting because I think the staging of the theft of the silver cup used for divination is supposed to be interpreted as more profound than like mere burglary of an expensive cup. This is the cup in which Joseph receives omens about the future. And if you remember the earlier part of the story, correctly interpreting omens about the future is how Joseph rose to his position of prominence in the first place. It was the dream interpretations, you know, the fat and lean cows and so forth. And it's also how Egypt is currently in a good position with this grain surplus during years of famine. So in a way, I think with that gloss, it makes sense to wonder if stealing Joseph's divination cup in the story is kind of an espionage caper. It would be like stealing the codes to the nuclear arsenal in a modern spy thriller. This is a piece of supernatural technology that helps give Egypt its strategic advantage over other nations.
That's fascinating. So I'm a little out of practice with this particular Bible story, but Joseph frames one of his brothers for stealing it.
But then he undoes it. Yeah, he
undoes it when another brother,
his
youngest brother is then fingered for the crime, and he's like, "Oh, I didn't want to enslave him.
No,
I just
want
to enslave." He wanted to enslave them both.
No. No, he didn't want to enslave any of them. I think he wanted to test them sort of. Mm. It's one of those kind of stories, I think.
Okay.
So he plants the, yeah, he frames his youngest brother who he loves for the crime. Then he says, I'm going to make him a slave. And then because the older brother is like, no, 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 take me instead. Then I think that that softens his heart and he forgives his brothers for what they did to him.
Complicated family dynamic, any way you cut it.
Yes.
But to your point, yeah, this is not just any cup or any silver cup. This is an artifact of the art of divination that Joseph practices. So this is vital. This has strategic importance for the Egyptians.
Yes, and in this specific story, it is divination in particular that has made Egypt prosperous.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road, the steeper the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend? Or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
And so anyway, thinking about the idea of dropping oil and water in a cup or a basin to receive messages from the heavens or from the gods, you know, while even mundane objects were often used for divination in the ancient world, it seems clear to me why the behavior of oil on water could inspire a kind of oracular fascination. Like there's that sense of strangeness and wonder about it that actually I found to be captured quite well in a passage in a letter written by Benjamin Franklin in the year 1773. We're going to get more into Benjamin Franklin, I think, in the next part in this series, but I wanted to read this passage because it articulates the kind of amazing weirdness here when you really pay attention to it. So Franklin's writing to somebody named William Brownrigg, again, November 1773, and he says, In these experiments, one circumstance struck me with particular surprise. There was the sudden, wide, and forcible spreading of a drop of oil on the face of the water, which I do not know that anybody has hitherto considered. If a drop of oil is put on a polished marble table, or on a looking glass that lies horizontally, the drop remains in place, spreading very little. But when put on water, it spreads instantly many feet around, becoming so thin as to produce the prismatic colors for a considerable space, and beyond them, so much thinner as to be invisible, except in its effect of smoothing the waves. Now, as I said, we'll come back to Benjamin Franklin in the next part of the series, but while I don't know if he was the first person to notice the way that oil spreads over the water, I actually somewhat doubt that. He definitely was not the first person to notice these other strange properties, like the prismatic colors that tend to shine out from oil spreading over a pool of water. And he was certainly not the first person to notice the apparent ability of oil to somehow soothe the chop of threatening waters.
Yeah, and this was the thing that drew us into this topic initially, because I know, for my part anyway, I don't think I'd come across this before, this idea of oil being used to calm storm waters, because, it just sounds so completely magical. And it will continue to sound completely magical while also having a basis in fact, in science, to at least a limited degree. So the accounts that we have dealing with this idea, these come from far after the time of ancient Babylon. One of the earliest, if not the earliest, it seems to go back to the writings of Aristotle. Aristotle lived 384 through 322 BCE, and a lot of his writings are generally just attributed to 350 BCE. So Aristotle brings this up in Problems or Problemata Physica, asking, why is it that the sea, which is heavier than fresh water, is more transparent? Is it because of its fattier composition? Now, oil poured on the surface of water makes it more transparent, and the sea, having fat in it, is naturally more transparent.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Several things there.
There's also a part in, I was looking up oil in various of these ancient writings, and I noticed in meteorology, Aristotle also points out that oil contains air. So there's a lot of, mixed information here.
Purely speculating here, this could be totally wrong, but I wonder if he's tempted to think that because oil floats on the top of water, therefore like air rises like bubbles through the water.
Yeah, that sounds likely. All right, I think we're going to come back to Aristotle, but we're going to skip ahead now to another favorite source on the show, and that is, of course, Roman historian Pliny the Elder, who lived 23 or 24 CE through 79 CE. I have to say, Pliny talks a lot about oils in the natural history. Like, if you just start searching up the word oil, you're going to find him mentioning all sorts of medicinal oils. There's also a section titled Waters Which Serve as a Substitute for Oil, concerning waters that emit light and heal wounds. So a lot in there for oil fans to consume and to try to make sense of. He's in general a big fan of oils, and he busts this out in Book 2, Chapter 106. There's a whole info dump regarding wisdom concerning the water. And he says, everything is soothed by oil, and that this is the reason why divers send out small quantities of it from their mouths, because it smooths any part which is rough and transmits the light to them. Okay, so I think this is tying in with what we were talking about earlier with Aristotle as well. And I've seen this particular bit translated as sprinkled from the mouth as well. So I believe the scenario here is that Pliny is sharing something that he has heard or read regarding free divers carrying some small quantity of oil in their mouths during the dive and spitting it out to make the surrounding water more visible during the dive while they're, looking for something like a mollusk. Now, the quote I read is from the Mayhoff translation of Pliny, and he notes in the notes for this that while this would be proven to be correct, the effect is greatly exaggerated both here and elsewhere. So keep that in mind as we're going here. We're dealing with, second and third hand accounts of these things that may have
They definitely seem to have a certain basis in fact, but also are greatly exaggerated in the retelling.
Okay, well, I imagine we'll return to the mechanics of this, if possible, in the next episode, but do you have any idea how exactly this would work that would make the water more visible?
Well, it's my understanding that what we're dealing with here is that, yeah, the idea is that oil will sort of smooth out the surface of troubled water, but that it will also smooth things out underneath the water. And if you are, you know, free diving, looking for, again, you know, fish or shells or what have you, that some small amount of oil released into that water would make it clearer and easier to see these things, and or allow light to filter down more effectively. Again, we'll get into the actual science of this probably in the next episode. And we have to keep in mind that, again, we're doing probably what, second or third hand information here. I'm guessing here this is, you know, something that Pliny had heard regarding some freediving people. And even though he would have certainly been familiar with ships and all, I don't remember in reading anything that indicated that he himself would have any firsthand experience with diving underneath the water. Now, another author who gets into some of this is Plutarch, who lived 46 through 119 CE. He also references Aristotle in Causes of Natural Phenomena. And according to Heinrich Hunnerfuss in Oil and Troubled Waters, A Historical Survey, this is likely referencing a lost portion of Aristotle's Problemata. Reads as follows. This is from Plutarch. What is the reason for the clearness and calm produced when the sea is sprinkled with oil? Is it, as Aristotle says, that the wind, slipping over the smoothness so caused, makes no impression and raises no swell? Or does this plausibly explain the external phenomena only? They say that when divers take oil into their mouths and blow it out in the depths, they get illumination and can see through the water. Surely it is impossible to adduce slipping of the wind in the cause there. Consider then whether the oil does not, by reason of its density, push and force aside the sea, which is earthy and irregular. Subsequently, when it flows back to its former position and draws together, intermediate passages are left in it, which offer transparency and clear visibility to the organs of sight.
Oh, that's interesting. So, again, I wonder if I'm understanding Plutarch right here, but it sounds like maybe he's saying that, like, when oil is spit out under the water, it kind of clears channels in the water. I wonder if that would work by like attracting particles in the water that would be making the water cloudy into the oil and then dragging them away with it as the oil rises.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I couldn't find much information on this particular detail of the scenario. Maybe I'll find something for the next episode. But yeah, it's like we'd have to put ourselves in the position of an ancient free diver who's I assume not using any kind of covering for their eyes. I did run across some mentions of these practices where they talked more like they were putting the oil in their eyes, which, again, I don't know how that's factoring into the sort of telephone game of, you know, second, third, and fourth hand reporting on this during ancient times, in addition to translation errors. All right. But in this, we've touched on this other big area, something that we're going to have a lot more to discuss in the next episode as well. And that is, hey, if you dump some quantity of oil, and the quantity seems to vary tremendously, if you dump that into a stormy sea, well, that's just going to smooth everything out. Smooth sailing, thanks to the oil.
Okay, what, do we have any stories about how this works?
We do. We have a pretty good story here, and it comes to us from the English monk Bede, who lived somewhere around 672 or 673 through 735.
Often known as the Venerable Bede. It's good if you can get venerable attached to your name.
Yes. So the year here that he's talking about is 651, and King Oswy, sometimes it's spelled Oswig, of Northumbria, sends out a priest to bring his bride home from Kent. And one Bishop Aidan blesses the priest and gives him some holy oil and tells him, when you set sail, you're going to encounter some really stormy weather. There's going to be some high winds. So remember to pour this oil that I'm giving you into the sea, and that's going to calm everything out.
Huh.
And this is later described as a flask. So I'm assuming we're talking about a magic potion quantity of oil here rather than, say, a barrel of oil.
Uh-huh.
So Bede claimed that everything happened as the bishop said it would,
When the storms came, the priest poured the flask of holy oil into the sea, and the storm died down. And Bede insisted that the miracle was no mere fable, that he had heard it from reliable sources close to the matter. So he was like, this works. This is not a tall tale. This is reality. Also worth noting, by the way, that Oswig was said that he and his queen had been gifted multiple holy relics, including a cross with a key to it made from the chains of the apostles Peter and Paul.
Okay, well, as much as this does just sound like a standard magical item legend, I think whether or not the story is plausible actually may be more a matter of degree rather than just like it could happen or it couldn't. I don't know about using oil to stop a storm, but in the next episode, we're going to end up exploring some surprising grains of truth in this kind of legend.
Yeah, and you might be surprised, too, at just what kind of legs this idea had concerning the idea that, yeah, you might want to have some oil on hand in case the water gets choppy.
So maybe we got to call it there for today, but we'll be back next time to talk about pouring oil on the seas.
Yeah, this one was more in depth than I expected, and you never expect it. But Ben Franklin often does show up. This is not the first episode where you don't expect Ben Franklin, but here he comes, sauntering up with his weird energy and strange ideas, becoming a part of the story of a particular invention or natural phenomena or what have you.
So tune in next time.
In the meantime, if you would like to listen to other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, well, you'll find them on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Those are the core episodes in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed. Listener mail on Monday. On Wednesday, a short form artifact or monster effect. And on Fridays, we set aside most serious concerns to just talk about a weird film on Weird House Cinema.
Huge thanks to our excellent audio producer, JJ Posway. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at CedarPoint.com.